and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today it's EcoNet News, Volume 26, Issue Number 9, September 30th, 2024. Quote of the month: for the first time in over 100 years, the river is now back in its historic channel. An extraordinarily profound moment to actually witness that, the reconnecting of a river. Mark Branson, CEO, Klamath River Renewal Corporation. Flanagan's Net Positive, the nuclear shotgun marriage. The power needs of data centers is expected to grow about 2.5 times its current capacity by 2030, from 3 to 4% of total U.S. power demand today to 11 to 12% by 2030. Others predict slightly lower values, 9% by 2030, doubling the current use. In either scenario, data centers may require up to 40 gigawatts of new electricity this decade. That's more than all of New England's power requirements. To get the power, data centers are turning to retired coal plants. Worse, they are being forced to go nuclear. It's a shotgun marriage. Skyrocketing computing and data demands, reported reductions in chip efficiencies, are growing the need for AI and machine learning-ready racks. Yahoo reports that the data center boom is giving clean energy a jolt. Renewable energy developments are moving too slow to fulfill data center demand and its extraordinary growth. Offshore wind cited with lengthy permitting and delays. Renewables often lack transmission to get to market. AI is causing an unprecedented need for computing power. It is the primary driver behind the data center explosion. One report notes that the climate community is gripped by a sense of panic that the AI scramble would turn into an emissions nightmare. Some data centers are running on coal, extending the life of coal plants slated for retirement. AI-related capital expenditures now exceed $300 billion, Forbes reports, and the technology is now 20% of all data center demand, pushing the need for hyperscale data centers, stretching the limits of computing power. AI is the intelligence behind everything from self-driving cars, navigation apps, and facial recognition systems. Data centers are now high-security operations. Artificial intelligence uses so much data and energy that its purveyors, like Microsoft and Oracle, are seeking nuclear power solutions for their data centers. Utilities that serve data centers are scrambling to figure out ways to meet the load. Constellation will restart three mothballed Three Mile Island nuclear reactors in Pennsylvania and sell 835 megawatts of power to Microsoft for 20 years. Constellation is planning to invest $1.6 billion to prepare and restart the plant. Amazon Web Services has signed a data center deal tying one of its Pennsylvania facilities to a nearby conventional nuclear power plant. Microsoft, Diamondback, and other companies are pursuing agreements on developing next-generation nuclear connections and projects. Oracle is developing plans for a new data center that would be powered by three SMRs, small modular reactors. Larry Ellison, Oracle's founder and CEO, told investors that he plans to build a gigawatt-scale data center that will be powered by three nearby SMR reactors. His nuclear-powered data centers is currently being designed without a timeline for its construction. Industry observers believe that the SMRs will come online, but not until 2030. Idaho National Laboratory is testing advanced nuclear technologies. Experts note that SMRs may be 25 to 200 megawatts in size and could be built partially underground, quote-unquote, to alleviate safety concerns. What happened to solar being the fastest growing resource? It is the least cost resource. And what about wind and batteries and vehicle grid integration? Aren't these the wave of the future? They are, but they just aren't coming online fast enough. And now apparently an AI we trust. It is a valuable and an unstoppable force. In its name, we keep old coal plants from their retirement, bellowing CO2, and we return to Three Mile Island, the site of one of the nation's worst nuclear accidents. The plant was closed years ago for economic reasons. Taking an old car out of the junkyard and firing it up is often problematic. And SMRs, which sound nice, kind of like baby elephants, are not yet developed. Are these the best way to power AI? I think not. It ain't a pretty shotgun marriage. Sailing the Coast of Maine, a travelogue. Second time aboard Zephyr, the beloved cruising sailboat owned by my friend and captain extraordinaire, Rob Pratt. Terry and I cruised with Rob two summers ago. In August each year, he sails the coast of Maine for the entire month, taking four different crews for a week each. A fortunate immersion into another world. What a contrast to life in Los Angeles. A nautical world. Boat camping on the water with good food, drink, and cheer. My guitar makes its second Zephyr voyage. We sail the pristine coast, catch good winds, and access gorgeous harbors. Day one, Saturday, August 24th, Rockland to Matinicus. Early drive up from Boston, met Rob at the Landings Marina in Rockland at 10. Shopped provision together, returned Enterprise rental. No Uber, so taxied back to the marina. Rob had already been cruising for 3 weeks, clearly loving it. If one sails at sea, be prepared. Go with a great sailor. Rob is truly seasoned. He and his family sailed competitively for years, mostly in Lightnings. He has cruised for years. Sailing is in his blood. He knows these waters well. That's comforting to his crew. Zephyr is a 35-foot sloop with a classy gray hull and blue waterline. Challenging it is to sail in Maine, a coastline of some 200 islands and innumerable shoals. GPS keeps us off the rocks. Thousands of lobster traps and their colorful marker buoys are scattered throughout Maine's coastal waters. The last thing you want is to get your prop tied up in a lobster pot line. Rob keeps his scuba gear on board for such occasions. Rob masterfully backed us out of the slip and off we went. The wind was perfect, steady, and from the south, one long tack to Matinicus Isle, 20 miles offshore. It's the farthest inhabited island on the east coast of America. First night aboard, the sound of gentle lapping of the water against the hull, a great sleep, my best in ages, the Zephyr magic. Day two, Sunday, August 25th, Matinicus to Monhegan. Cereal and fruit for breakfast, dinghy ashore, no boat dock, just a scary ladder up the pier, and of course it was low tide. I scampered up the ladder with the painter to tie up the dinghy. Matinicus is a 2.3-mile square island with a year-round population of 53. Rob walked with me for a bit and then pointed to a pile of rock and said, "Just go there and round the point. You'll find the airstrip and can walk back that way." Did so, a far more strenuous hike than I expected. Lots of rock and bouldering by myself. At last, the airstrip, its grassy runway, slopes quite dramatically to the sea. Met Jennifer on the walk back, the girlfriend of a lobsterman. She said the clean waters of Matinicus makes the best tasting lobster, so sweet, in fact, that you need no butter. Motored to Monhegan Island, where we would stay for 2 nights. It was and still is a renowned summer retreat for artists. Lots of galleries, some classy old hotels. After mooring and taking the dinghy ashore, we quickly met a gruff local who said that we'd have to pay $70 a night for his mooring. So we found Harbor Master Sherman, paid him $40 a night for the best mooring in the harbor. That's given the tides and waters within the Monhegan Harbor. A little high, but it was a good spot, away from the ferries and main channel. We had two nice calm nights there. Day three, Monday, August 26th, Monhegan Island. Hiked Monhegan Island. Took the number one trail all the way around the island. Lots of poison ivy, some marked, most not. Not easy hiking at all. Lots of roots and rocks to scramble. The east side cliffs are majestic. Burnt Head, White Head, and Black Head. Elevations 140, 160, and 160 feet respectively. Found the north side of the island deserted. After the 360-degree hike, swam a bit at Fish Beach, not to be confused with Swim Beach, where no one swims. Visited the microbrewery, made some friends, and enjoyed an IPA and a bit of internet access. Dinner at the grand old Island Inn with Rob, talking energy and celebrating life. Day 4, Tuesday, August 27th, Monhegan to Squirrel to Booth Bay. Foggy morning in Monhegan, less than 50 yards of visibility at times. Motoring with radar set to 1/8 of a mile to be able to see other ships and avoid lobster pots. Thank goodness for modern nautical technology. With plenty of time but miles offshore, our radar detected another ship approaching. Then quickly it sleuthed out of the fog and passed us by, too close for comfort. Fog lifted and after a few hours we stopped at Squirrel Island, a playground for the rich at the mouth of Booth Bay Harbor. Gorgeous vineyard-like homes, an elevated walkway trail circles much of the island. The rest is a meandering coastal trail. Another short island trek under my belt. Back to Zephyr, sailed into Booth Bay Harbor, got mooring at Tugboat Inn Marina, went ashore for showers, $1.25, and Wi-Fi. Rob addressed his Solomon Islands work. I ran payroll. Then lobster dinner, good IPA. Colorful, expressive waitress named April took good care of us. Well, at least when she wasn't flirting with the next table. The theme was Tupelo, her hometown in Mississippi. Random. Lots of laughs. Day 5, Wednesday, August 28th, Booth Bay to Five Islands. Clear skies and wind shifted. With a better forecast, we changed the plan and stay only one night at Booth Bay. Fueled up 3.1 gallons of diesel only and filled our water tanks. Bought blocks of ice and headed to Five Islands, my favorite spot from our trip 2 years earlier. Got there and found the lobster shack was closed. Oh no! Day 6, Thursday, August 29th, Five Islands to Snow Island. Time for another walk. Highly valued when sailing. Rob's dinghy service to the pier at Five Islands. Immediately met a local, Jim Faulkner, and we fell in, talked about boats and woodworking. Did a four-mile hike. Surprised that one lady drove by, stopped, rolled down her window, and offered me a ride. Far from L.A., indeed. Back at Five Islands, hike rewarded. Lobster shack open for lunch. Rob came ashore and we each had a 1.5-pound lobster with corn on the cob. Yum! Big sail and high winds, 20-plus knots towards Casco Bay. Rob was in his element in the high winds. Upriver we went to Upper Quahog Bay to Snow Island, a hidden gem out of the wind. The waters were warmer and the seas calmer there. We loop our bow line through a mooring without a pendant, a bit of a trick made possible by putting me in a dinghy with oars to reach the mooring, a great anchorage and another restful night. Day 7, Friday, August 30th, Snow Island to Eagle Island to Jewel. Dinghy ride in the morning exploring the shores of Snow Island, the quiet Torquedo electric motor zooming us around the still morning waters, lots of birds, still and shallow waters, the beginning of another great day. Dropped our mooring line and sailed to Eagle Island, the island owned by Admiral Parry. Sir William Edward Parry is known as the first explorer to reach the North Pole. In reality, his 1827 exploration set a record as the farthest north to the 82nd parallel, 82 degrees north of the equator. His record held for 50 years. The North Pole is at the 90th latitude. His main summer home is Prominent, now a museum. He kept his dog sledding huskies on a nearby island. He used a bullhorn to scold them and quiet their barking at night. We rowed ashore, pulled the dinghy up on the rocks, chat with a park ranger, and visit the admiral's home. I hiked the trail. Hard to imagine a family summer here, the main coast in all of its splendor. Idyllic settings, but cold water, rough seas, and rocky shores. Maine is for the rugged. Off to Jewel Island for the final night. Anchor in Cocktail Cove, dinghy to shore. Walked across the island to the Punch Bowl. What a spot. It's low tide and the bowl is packed with seaweed. Back to cocktail, met Dane, a fellow sailor, contagious smile. Gave me a Zodiac lift back to Zephyr. He plays cello in a rock band in Portland. Great vibes from him. Day 8, Saturday, August 31st, Jewel to Falmouth. Jewel Island, a jewel. Final day, avocado, veggie omelets with turkey, bacon, and toast. Then ashore I go, another great hiking island, clearly a favorite for camping. Really nice, secluded campsites all around the island. Easily accessible from Portland, 8 miles away. Jewel was part of the harbor defenses of Portland in World War II. 3 gun batteries were constructed on the island. So were 2 anti-motor torpedo boat batteries. Hiking, this time to the watchtowers and bunker, vestiges of German U-boat defenses. Climbed up both towers for 270-degree views. Met a family from Cumberland. Used flashlight and walked slowly and carefully through the dark catacombs of the bunker, said to be haunted. Hard to imagine this in operation as an outpost for military defenses. It was dank and dark. Troops bustling about here? Trekked to Bowie Beach, Smuggler's Cove, back to Cocktail Cove, eaten alive by mosquitoes. The only one experienced all week that got me. Pulled up anchor and sailed back to Zephyr's home marina, handy boat, Falmouth, Maine. Final leg of the trip, and out came the tuna fish held in reserve for our final sandwiches. Rob's month-long venture was ending, his fulfillment palpable. Cleaned up the boat and ferried to the dock by a ferryman of few words. Rob's wife picked us up and takes us home. We have lots to share. Great to meet her, such fun. Amazing trip, amazing Thai food in Exeter. Lucky guy I am. Another deep sensory immersion into coastal Maine. Lots of fresh air and vibrant vistas, lots of cool water, and the calming effects of the sea. Then back to reality. A shuttle to Logan, a quick flight to JFK, the LIRR to Syosset, time in Oyster Bay. For days, I felt my body sway, just like I was on board. After a while, that ended. JFK and Six Flags Solar. The Sunday campaign reports that renewables now provide 30% of U.S. utility scale capacity and provide 25% of all electricity generated in the country. In 2024 year to date, the U.S. Energy Information Administration reports that solar has accounted for 75% of all new capacity additions. That's utility scale wholesale generation. Now we shift to behind-the-meter installations, systems owned and operated by utility customers, those offsetting retail rates with solar. Huge! A brand new terminal at JFK, the largest terminal at Kennedy Airport, the largest solar array in New York City, and the largest airport terminal array in the country. The new Terminal 1 will be topped by 6.5 football fields of solar. The solar array is 6.36 megawatts in size. It's an integral part of the 12-megawatt microgrid that will distribute energy from solar, fuel cells, 3.8 megawatts, and batteries, 1.5 megawatts, 3.5 megawatt hours, through a localized, self-contained energy system. The system is a microgrid that can operate in an integrated mode with the power grid or independently. The Port Authority's chairman noted that the microgrid continues our march to net zero. The project is fully financed through an energy-as-a-service contract delivered by Alpha Structure, a Schneider Electric company. A long-term agreement fixes operating costs without upfront costs and with an ongoing guaranteed performance. The integrated microgrid solution will recover heat from the fuel cells to generate chilled water and hot water for the terminal. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey manages the airport. It has a goal to decarbonize its facilities by 2050. It is also building a 12-megawatt solar canopy at JFK's long-term parking lot 9, coupled with 7.5 megawatts of battery storage for airport use and 6 megawatts for community solar. The Port Authority also has a 5-megawatt solar system at Newark Liberty International Airport and a 1.5 megawatt rooftop solar system at LaGuardia Airport. Six Flags is an amusement park located in the heart of the Santa Clarita Valley, north of Los Angeles. It is erecting 637,000 square feet of solar carports over the main guest parking lot and the team member lot. All told, the solar system will deliver 12.4 megawatts of power. That's enough power for Six Flags Magic Mountain and Hurricane Harbor to be entirely self-sufficient on an annual basis, running on solar power. The solar array is a major beacon within the entertainment industry. It demonstrates environmental and corporate leadership. It also directly supports the comfort of guests, keeping them cool. There will now be 3,544 shaded parking spots for guests and 771 for team members. The guest lot will also have 30 EV chargers. Six Flags hopes that its solar step will be an inspiration for other corporations that can also have economic prosperity and environmental responsibility. They are not mutually exclusive. The project is being developed and built by Solar Optimum, financed by DSD Renewables. It includes 2 megawatts, 8 megawatt hours of battery storage for grid services. Six Flags continues to work on its environmental, social, and governance practices. The solar system in Santa Clarita will be the third solar installation at Six Flags. The others are in Northern California and New Jersey. Together, the three sites rank first as the largest amount of on-site solar of any U.S. organization. Maglev Automobiles. Some are calling it a remarkable leap towards the future of transportation. Some say it is the beginning of a new chapter in automotive engineering. Others question whether this is a redefining moment. In any event, it is innovative, applying magnetic levitation, maglev, technology to the automotive industry. So far, maglev technology has been focused on trains, generating excitement in Germany and Japan. The maglev car technology is being developed by the Quantum Machines Unit at the Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology in Japan. It has the promise of unparalleled efficiency. By floating above the surface, cars will avoid friction and its resistive force. This leaves only air resistance and electromagnetic drag. Maglevs use magnetic field to counteract gravitation, to repel the surface, to hover a few centimeters above specially designed tracks. Think the potential benefits of maglev cars. They would not need engines and or batteries. This reduces the weight of the vehicle, lowers the manufacturing costs, and leaves more room for luggage. Oh yes, no need for brakes. That's done electromagnetically. One expert noted that we could see a new era of transportation where traditional engines and batteries become obsolete, replaced by lightweight, energy-efficient maglev vehicles. It's hard to imagine the automotive industry going maglev. How can maglevs dovetail with our automotive use patterns? The application seems limited. Maglev cars will need specially designed tracks. While maglev trains have higher top speeds, superior acceleration and deceleration, lower maintenance costs, improved gradient handling, and lower noise than conventional trains, they are more expensive to build and cannot use existing infrastructure. Same for cars? Freeing the Klamath River. In August and September, crews were breaking down the last remaining cofferdams, the infrastructure built to divert water around the larger dams. This was the culmination of a decades-long push by tribal communities in Siskiyou County, California, to remove 4 dams along the Klamath River. It was once the third largest salmon-producing river on the West Coast and teemed with salmon and trout in what seemed to be an inexhaustible supply. The Klamath River Renewal Corporation, KRRC, announced that the final stage of the restoration began in August and is expected to be complete in September, restoring historic water flows to the river for the first time in over a century. Now the river can flow freely between Lake Iwauna in Klamath Falls, Idaho, and the Pacific Ocean since the dams were constructed. We've officially turned over to the river to its historic channel at all of the dam sites, noted KRRC's public information officers. For thousands of years, Chinook salmon have been a fundamental source of physical, spiritual, and economic sustenance to tribal communities throughout the Klamath Basin. A tribal member states that our sacred duty to our children, our ancestors, and for ourselves is to take care of the river, and today's event represents a fulfillment of that obligation. The dams were built by the California Oregon Power Company, COPCO, between 1902 and 1962 for hydroelectricity. That company merged into Pacific Power and Light in 1961. It is now known as PacifiCorp. The fight to remove the dams began decades ago when the salmon were threatened by poor water quality and insufficient water flows. In 2002, a massive fish kill caused tens of thousands of Chinook to die. After that, the Yurok and Karuk tribes began a fierce advocacy campaign, a plan to remove the dams. The Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement was approved by federal regulators in 2022, restoring hundreds of miles of spawning grounds, improving water quality to support the return of the salmon. Skywind microturbines. Yes, an advertisement caught my eye. 50% off Skywind microturbines on sale for only $1,499. They are 1 kilowatt machines. They come with inverters that adjust to either 230 volt or 110 volt systems. The $1,499 kit comes with power supply, high-performance grid inverter, turbine computer for optimum performance, automatic braking system, integrated power supply. The customer supplies the 2-inch pole, its foundation, and any necessary guy wires. Wind has many benefits. In those locations where it is windy, wind systems cost less than solar, and wind generation is not limited to daytime hours or good weather. Wind can be a nice partner. Complement for solar to fill in on those times when there is less solar than demand for power. And Skywind systems are reportedly quiet thanks to highly developed aerodynamics and a special coating on the rotor blades to ensure quiet operation at the same time to prevent annoying light reflections. So does Microwind make sense for you? Skywind's website recommends 3.5 to 4 meters per second or 7.8 to 8.9 miles per hour average wind speeds for systems to be cost effective. See the Global Wind Atlas online to see if your region has or has not sufficient average wind speeds. Note that the Skywind systems have been tested under extreme conditions. They use all metal turbine technology. The company has deployed more than 10,000 units worldwide. Back to the tower, you're on your own. They must be at least 30 feet tall and erected to maintain vertical operations within 1 degree at 50% load. The turbine and its housing is designed to slip over the top of a 60 millimeter diameter pole. Then two screws tighten the assembly to the top of the pole. Guy wires are used to make and keep them vertical. There's also a need for suitable ground and foundation for tower construction. Skywind systems can also be roof mounted. Some perspective. Imagine a 3-foot in diameter circle, a small segment of a pipeline. Now think of how much energy comes through that aperture in the form of sunlight. You've got to get the angle right, and then the photons of light gently filter through the opening. Next, imagine a strong wind blowing through the same aperture. It's powerful. It blows back your hair. It's active energy. So much more wind energy passes through the aperture than solar. If you have wind and you can, use it. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.